Before we look at the book of Judges, I'm sure it would be useful for us to get some background concerning the book. The general period, which we call the period of the Judges, covers that period of time between Joshua's conquest of Canaan and the setting up of the Israelite monarchy. It spills over from the book of Judges into the early chapters of Samuel, a period of around about 200 or 300 years. Now, the conquest of Canaan, which took place under Joshua, was not complete. There were pockets of Canaanites throughout the country, and these people who had not been exterminated created many problems for the Israelite people. The Israelites existed in the various tribal sections, the areas that had been allotted to the various tribes, and there was no central government in the country at that stage. The general pattern that you'll meet as you go through the book of Judges is something like this, that the people followed in the ways of God, more or less, for a while, and then they departed from God. They followed the ways of the Canaanites, the local religions. God punished them by sending various oppressors, some of the local peoples themselves, sometimes neighboring peoples, and these came in and they subjugated the local Israelite people. This went on for a period of time, and then when the people had had enough, they would repent, they'd turn to God, they'd cry for mercy. God in his grace would have mercy. He'd send a deliverer. The enemy would be overthrown. There'd be peace restored again. But once the people were settled down to a fairly comfortable way of life again, we find that they drifted back into their old ways, and so the cycle was repeated. Now, these deliverers that God raised up are often called judges. A very odd name when you think of it. Why call a deliverer, a great army general or someone like that, why call him a judge? Well, sprinkled in with these military hero type judges, there were also civil judges. People whose exploits don't involve any military conquests at all, as far as we can see. The word judge, as I understand it here, means a person who carried out God's judgment. That's why he's called a judge. He's not necessarily a chap who sits with a wig on in some court of law. He was a person who carried out God's judgment, either in getting rid of the oppressors or in administering justice among the people of Israel in their daily affairs. Another thing I think we should notice before we look at this book is that the various people who are mentioned, the various heroes, Gideon and Samson and Jephthah and the like, and the areas of concern, are not necessarily involving the whole of the land of Canaan. Now, this will come out as we move through the studies. The oppressors normally concentrated their efforts in one particular area, and the judge who was raised up may have been a deliverer only for a particular number of tribes in some certain region of the land. Sometimes the subjugations by these different nations may have been overlapping. Some of them may have even been concurrent. There may have been one oppression by a certain nation in this part of Israel, while at the same time there was another oppression by another peoples in another part of Israel. But it's probably more important in Judges than almost any other book of the Old Testament for us to really grasp the regions of the country, where the tribes were and where the various nations were who oppressed those tribes, because an understanding of this is really essential to an understanding of the book. Now, it won't affect us so much this morning, because I want to look at the first two chapters and a bit, and that more or less is an introduction. But as you move through the various periods of the different judges, you find that the area of interest is concentrated in certain parts of Israel and involves certain limited nations round about who oppressed them. Now, the big problem in Israel was that the 12 tribes were all doing their own thing. There was very little unity in Israel, and everybody was out for himself. It was a very selfish sort of an era. And this was part of the reason why the folks departed from God. In fact, you might say they had this unselfishness and the troubles because they had failed to put God first. Now, if they had have devoted themselves to the Lord Jehovah, as they should have, that would have been a unifying force in the nation which bound them together. But instead, we find they're all going their own ways, and their departure from God brought upon them these political troubles as well. And of course, the problem really goes back to the fact that they weren't obedient in the first place. They had not exterminated the peoples whom they should have exterminated, and the peoples who were left over in the land were a source of trouble later on. So that was another reason as to why there was no unity, because these pockets of Canaanites separated the different tribal peoples of Israel, and they weren't able to join together as they should have. Also, the central place of worship at Shiloh, the tabernacle, that wasn't accessible to everybody because of the breakup through these enemy nations that were scattered around the place. And then, of course, there was the breakup within the country itself, the terrain, the mountains and valleys, the Jordan River down the middle, which separated the eastern tribes from the western tribes. And so there are a whole lot of factors working as to why there was not the unity that there should have been among the 12 tribes. Now, if we look at chapter 1 of Judges, you find that this really summarizes the conquest and the incompletion of that conquest. It starts off by saying, after the death of Joshua, and then it goes on to talk about various things. Now, actually, what's recounted in the chapter which follows happened before the death of Joshua. And I think the words after the death of Joshua are really a title to the whole book, because that really is what the book of Judges is about. What happened after the death of Joshua? But what is left in the remainder of chapter 1 is what happened before the death of Joshua. That is, he came in, they conquered the peoples, but not completely. And so chapter 1 outlines the conquest under Joshua and underlines the fact that it was not carried through to its fullness. Now, we're not going to read the whole chapter through. I'll just make a few references. Notice in verse 8, it says that the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. Well, that sounds good, until you come down to verse 21, where you find that very soon after they took Jerusalem, it was retaken by the local people, the Jebusites, and it remained in Jebusite hands for many years afterwards, way up until the time of David, actually. You find in verse 9 of chapter 1 that after this, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the hill country, in the Negeb, which is the dry southern region, and in the lowlands. Now, that's another feature you'll find coming through time and again in the book of Judges, that the Israelites were basically a hill people. They were able to take control of the hill country. They also had control of this southern part, the dry Negeb, the south of Palestine, the low hill country, but the plain land they were not able to conquer. And it was these plain areas which really caused the strife in the years which followed. While we're dealing with Judah, if you come to verse 12, you'll find Caleb is mentioned there. And he had said that whoever attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, I will give him Aksar, my daughter, as a wife. And we find that Othniel took it. Now, Othniel we're going to meet later on in chapter 3. He won a great victory, and he received Caleb's daughter as his wife. He also received some territory, but it wasn't well watered. And so you find that the begging daughter comes to her father in verse 15, and she says, give me also a present, seeing you've set me in the land of the Negeb, this very dry region, give me also some springs of water. Not much use having land with no water. And so Caleb, being a generous father, gave her the upper springs and also the lower springs. So much for Judah. Actually, if you come down to verse 18, you find Judah is still spoken of there, where they took the cities of Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Now, they are three of the cities of the Philistines. The other two, of course, are Gath and Ashdod. These five cities of the Philistines, with their five rulers, the five lords of the Philistines, feature again as we move through the story. I'm just touching on these things lightly in chapter 1, because almost all of these are going to crop up as we get on into the book of Judges, the five cities of the Philistines. But notice verse 19. The Lord was with Judah, and again Judah took possession of the hill country. But he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain, because they had chariots of iron. And that's a refrain that you're going to find repeated also in the book. So much for the southern region, or the central and the southern region. Because when Israel came into the land, the general strategy of Joshua was to come across the river, take the central portion, Jericho, Gilgal, Ai, Bethel, Shechem, Jerusalem, all these areas in the central portion, then to turn south down through the Negeb, which was later occupied by Judah, as we've just read, and then to turn north and take over all that northern area. That's referred to in the remainder of the chapter. And again, you have this refrain that although the various parts of the country were taken, the tribes who occupied those parts did not succeed in driving out all the local inhabitants. Commencing at verse 27, a reference now to the northern sections. We've touched on the central and southern sections in what has gone before. Now, in verse 27, as you move further north, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of various places. Verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in certain places. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, Asher did not drive out. And we're going further north as you move through. And it's the same story, that these nations were not driven out. one final reference in chapter 1, and that's in verse 34, where it says that the Amorites, now the Amorites is just another name for the Canaanites, the local peoples in other words, and the Philistines were one of those local peoples. These Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country. They did not allow them to come down to the plain. Now just mention that there. It again bears out what I said before about the local people occupying the plain lands and the Israelites being pushed up into the hills all the time. But this is of particular relevance concerning the tribe of Dan, because when we come to those final five chapters of Judges that you never hear preached on, those odd chapters at the end, you'll find that this reference suddenly takes on a lot of meaning, because two whole chapters really turn on our understanding of the Danites being pushed out of their territory by the local peoples, and also squeezed out of it partly by the more aggressive Israelites who were their older brothers. So much for chapter 1. Not the sort of chapter you want to spend a lot of time on in a talk such as this, but it's very instructive if you want to go through it privately. But it brings us on to chapter 2, and we start now to get into the meat of the book. And you find a summary of events more or less in verse 3. God says, "So now I say, I will not drive them out before you." We better get the connection there, I think. What's happened here is that these people have not carried out God's commandments. They have not been faithful. We're always looking for guidance. Christians love talks on guidance. And yet so often, what we really need is not guidance, but simply obedience. So many of the things are written there plainly for us, and all we have to do is to do them. And in the process of doing them, that will normally amount to a fair amount of the guidance we need. But somehow we're always looking for special indications. And what God is looking for is straight out, ordinary, plain obedience in the day-by-day things of life. These people were not obedient. They had not carried out God's instructions. And the people that were left behind, the local peoples that were left behind because of their disobedience, these people became a snare to them. The Israelites worshipped their gods, and now God said also he was going to use those people who had not been driven out. He was going to use those people to punish the disobedient Israelites. And that's what he says now in verse 3. "So now I say, I will not drive them out before you. I will not drive these people out before you, but they shall become adversaries to you, and their gods shall be a snare to you." The very people that Israel failed to get rid of, those people became the source of their problem. And that really is a summary of the problems which Christians face, all of us face. That those things that we fail to get the victory over, that we fail to exterminate in our own lives, those things later become the snares to us. The things that we don't exercise our control over will eventually exercise their control over us. We got very close to it in the reading we had before in Romans 6, stopped just a couple of verses short of a verse that I had in mind, where Paul was saying, "To whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his slaves will you be to whom you obey, whether of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness." And here is an illustration of that. People had failed to conquer these people. Now these people, in turn, are going to conquer them. And it will be also with us if we fail to deal with those areas of our lives which need dealing with. In the end, they will get the dominion. We come down then to verse 11, and from verse 11 through to the end of the chapter, we have really a summary of the cycle that I mentioned before, this cycle of following God and then departing from God, being subjugated by foreigners, crying out to God, being delivered, going okay for a while, and then slipping back into old ways. This would be a convenient time to talk about the religion of Baal, because it's going to crop up time and again as we move through the book. The local Canaanite gods were known as Baalim. The I-M on the end is simply the Hebrew plural. Call it Baals if you want to be up to date with your English. Baals, or Baalim, plural of Baal, which is singular. That's the male god. The female gods were called Ashtaroth, which was the plural of Ashtoreth, or Asherim, which was the plural of Asherah. Now all of these gods were considered to be gods of nature, gods of fertility. When the Israelites came into the land, you can see that very quickly they could see some sort of similarity between their god and these local Canaanite gods. because Jehovah was a God of nature. He was the creator. The whole world was his. And so they could see this similarity. There's a further similarity because the word Baal is a local word which the Hebrews had in their language, as the Canaanites had in theirs, and it simply meant husband or owner or master. And they said, well, that's funny, you know, because our God, Jehovah, he is our husband. He's our master, he's our owner, he's our Baal. And then another thing they noticed was that these Canaanite people often erected their altars on hilltop sites. And beside these altars they had poles or a grove of trees, which are called Asherim, after the god for whom they were named. And when the Israelites came in, they said, well, you know, we've always worshipped God on hilltop sites too. You can go back in your mind to the stories of Genesis and Exodus, and you'll find time and again how people went up into the hills, Abraham and Isaac and Moses, up into the mountain to receive the Lord, up in the mountain to offer sacrifices, to build altars. You'll get it as you go through Samuel. Natural thing to do, to go into the high and lofty places to worship the great God. And here are all the Canaanite peoples with their high places. Well, you know what happened. The Israelites accommodated to this. Here you have a people who have a God of nature, a God of fertility. They have hilltop site. He's the husband, he's the master, he's the Lord, he's the owner of them. And the next thing you know, they are worshipping Jehovah more or less as if he is a sort of super Baal. Accommodating themselves, you see, to the current opinions and viewpoints of the people among whom they live. That's the very same temptation that comes upon us. Our idea of God can very easily be coloured by the type of society in which we live. And a lot of people have got the idea that God, again, is some sort of superstar. Or if you're politically minded, that God's a prime minister or a president. Or if you're some other way minded, that God is some great personage that's prominent in the media. Because the type of culture or country we live in tends to colour our thinking. And the next minute you know, you've imposed this thinking upon God, and you see God as nothing more, you might say, than one of these super personalities around the place. And we're particularly prone to that sort of thinking, the way we're brainwashed with the mass media of communication, TV and the like, where all sorts of personality cults are built up around people and all sorts of ideals are put before us as things we should aim for. This is really, in essence, the same sort of thing that was happening here. Worshipping Jehovah simply as if he was a Baal. And so it leads eventually to Baalism and all the evils. And you find then that not only are the Israelites worshipping Jehovah as if he's a Baal, they're committing some of the evils of the Baal worshippers. Because Baal was the god of fertility, they, the people, had what they call fertility rites. If you wanted increase in your crops, increase in your flocks or your herds or even your family, Baal was the one who'd give you the increase. And so the next thing you know is they have religious or semi-religious immoral rites which go along with some of the worship at these Baal altars. They had prostitutes available for these fertility rites. And so people acted out with these prostitutes what they wanted the god to do. It was a demonstration before the god that they wanted increase in their families, flocks, crops, or whatever. That, of course, was the way these religions worked. And again, you find it referred to time and time again, how Israel played the harlot after these gods. Literally, that's what was involved in these temple prostitutes, these cult prostitutes referred to time and again throughout these stories of Judges, Samuel and Kings. But there was also the spiritual prostitution which went with it, because Jehovah and his people were supposed to be bound together in a covenant, just like a husband and wife are bound together, and to be loyal to each other. And again, Israel was not loyal to Jehovah. The people departed from Jehovah, and this was a spiritual adultery. And so you have both the literal and the spiritual there, as all this harlotry took place among the people. And it's referred to time and again in Judges. Let us then read from verse 11 through to the end of chapter 2, and that will give us the pattern into which most of the stories that follow will fit. Now we'll get into the nitty-gritty of some of the judges tonight when we look at Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar and Deborah. Let us begin reading in chapter 2, verse 11, and as you're probably aware, I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they went after other gods, from among the gods of the people who were round about them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord, and they served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. And so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. He gave them over to plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the power of their enemies round about, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in sore straits. And then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the power of those who plundered them. And yet they did not listen to the judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and behaved worse than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them, and they did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. It's tragic, isn't it? And this is so typical of human nature. It's still happening. It's happening with us. Not literally in these circumstances that these people have, but so often we'll go along with God while things are comfortable and moving along nice and easily. We have no problems, and we tend to get very slack in our spiritual exercises, in our devotion to God, in our trust, in our obedience, in our faith and dependence. And then some calamity occurs, and we go running back to God, repenting and crying out to God for mercy, have mercy upon us and help us. And God in his grace so often responds. And having got things straight again, one's peace and prosperity are restored. There is this drifting away, until some calamity befalls us, and back to God we go again. And it shouldn't be like that, but unfortunately it very often is. And the remarkable thing is that God is so gracious to us. I think it's also significant here, the emphasis that was placed in the verse we just read there about how the people followed God as long as that judge exercised control over them. But as soon as that judge died, as soon as there was not the strong leadership, back the people went into their old ways. Again, I think there's a lesson for us there, that so many Christians seem to be okay as long as there is some sort of strong leadership, or as long as there's a lot of activity, or there are a lot of people to bolster them up and to keep them going, and they're great stuff as long as they've got this strong leadership to carry them along. And you put them out by themselves, and very often you find there's not too much there. It makes you wonder just how much inner conviction there really was in the first place. This was what happened with these people. They were okay as long as they had the strong leadership, but as soon as the strong leadership disappeared, their spirituality was not all that it was made out to be. The test is not how well we go when we're in a meeting such as this and our faith is feeling strong because of the communion we're having together. The test is how we go when we're on our own, when we don't have this bolstering effect of other Christians round about us. And that really is the test. And so we find then that the people departed from God more often than not. The reforms that these judges effected were very often external. And I'm not saying that in criticism of the judges. The judges may have got rid of some of the idolatry. They may have corrected some of the ills. And that has to be done. And the people may have followed suit. But if there's no inner reform, then all the outer reforms that take place don't accomplish anything in the long run. Now, in our assemblies, we, again, probably need some reform. We certainly have to look at our structures. We have to look at the things we do. And some of the things badly need second thoughts. They may need changing. But that in itself is not going to affect the type of change that is really going to do things. It's only as people are changed within themselves that you get the lasting reform. And so you don't have one or the other, you have both. But here it appears that many of them only had the change of the forms, the change of the externals. Things were changed, procedures were changed, but the people within themselves were not changed. And as soon as the strong personality departed, back they snuck into their old ways again. I think we all need to examine ourselves as well as to examine our corporate activities. And only as we ourselves are changed as people is anything in the church or in the activity of God going to be changed. And so we find then in verse 19, whenever the judge died, they turned back and behaved worse than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They didn't drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. Verse 20, then the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. Before we saw that God was gracious to them, and now God is angry with them. God is gracious, God is kind, but never get the idea that God is sweet and sugary. Never get the idea that God is meek and mild, wouldn't say boo to a goose. God is long-suffering, he is gracious, he is kind, but he is also a God of justice. He is one to be feared. I see you have in your library some of the Narnia stories of C.S. Lewis. Those who have read them will know that Aslan was not a tame lion. God is not a tame God. He's one you can trust. He's one who is kind. But he's also one to be feared. We can't take him lightly. We can't take him for granted. He's not there to be pulled out when we want him and thrown away when we don't want him. He's not like some teddy bear that comforts you when you're a child is in need of some sort of comfort. Linus's rug or something like this, and you have this thing to give comfort when you need it, and then when you feel you don't need it, just throw it away again. God is not mocked, and God is not going to be treated like that. He's not there for our convenience. And these people had to learn that God was not there just for their convenience. And if they were going to treat God like this, they couldn't expect to go calling to God whenever they wanted to, and at the snap of their fingers, God was going to spring to attention and start doing things for them. They learned that God was a God to be feared. And sometimes he delivered them into the hands of their enemies for a very long time, 5, 10, 20, 40 years, so that they might learn that he was the holy God. And in his good time, he responded to their pleas. And so the anger of the Lord in verse 20 was kindled against Israel, and he said, "Because this people have transgressed my covenant which I commanded their fathers, and have not obeyed my voice, I will not henceforth drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, that by them I may test Israel, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not." And so the Lord left those nations, not driving them out at once, and he did not give them into the power of Joshua. And so the people were to be tested to see how true they were to God. And when the testing time comes for us, never let us say that God tempted us. Never let us make this mistake of putting testing for temptation. God tests us, but God does not tempt us to evil. Let me read those well-known words from James as we conclude. "Blessed is the man who endures trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. But let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. And then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings death. But rather," he says, "when you meet trials, these are for the testing of your faith. And the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And so you must let steadfastness have its full effect." And then he says, "you'll be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." How do we respond then to the tests which we confront? Do we make excuses, as these people did, and more or less blame God for tempting them to evil? Or do we realize that the temptations are something which spring from the evil within us, and realize that any test we confront is going to sort out the men from the boys and find out those who are loyal to God and those who are not? And I think the experiences of the people of Israel here in the time of the judges bears witness to the truth of these words that we've just read from the book of James. In view of all this then, let us count it all joy, my brethren, when we meet various trials, knowing that the testing of our faith produces steadfastness.